you very much to James and the organizing committee for the invitation to come and speak today about some of the work that we've been doing at the Public Health Agency related to sexually transmitted infections. And I'm really going to speak in kind of a broad public health sense for most of my talk, primarily because these are projects that are works in progress. So I'm going to talk about some of the heterogeneity we've seen in the data for specific populations of interest, and then I'm going to talk about some of the ways in which we've been thinking about using modeling, different types of modeling methodologies to address some of that heterogeneity. So the work certainly has not been done in isolation, so I should be sure to mention that this is work that has been done in collaboration with my colleagues at the University of Toronto, as well as the Public Health Agency in our group, as well as in community-acquired infections. And also some work that, some preliminary work that I've been doing with Paula Pasquale and Carolina, who are from the UConn Department of Health and Social Services, as well as some of the ESIS participants. And ESIS is something, is a program we have at the Public Health Agency that stands for Enhanced Street Youth Surveillance. And essentially it's a survey instrument that is administered every 2 years to street youth in urban areas of Canada, and the data is collected. And I'm going to talk specifically about some of the data that comes from that survey. So just to give you a little bit of context in terms of the world in which I work, is that my work is very much has an applied focus and is motivated by the realities of public health practice in terms of what people in local public health units or at different levels are actually interested in using a model to think about in terms of rolling out an intervention. And oftentimes the questions tend to be highly focused and specific. So public health practitioners have a specific intervention that they're very interested in thinking about, but perhaps it's too costly or too difficult to actually try to run a trial, and they would like to use a model to try and look at some of the ways in which that intervention might affect the population. At the Public Health Agency, we certainly have a strong interest in vulnerable populations and social determinants of health, and that's one of the reasons why the work we're doing around street-involved youth is very much of interest to our community-acquired infections branch in terms of populations that have limited access to health care. And also one of the things that we do a lot at the Public Health Agency is around knowledge translation in terms of collaborating with our epidemiology and public health practice colleagues to think about how we communicate models and how we can work together to do work that's relevant and applicable to public health practitioners. So my talk today, I'm going to focus on four specific things. I'm going to start by revisiting the conceptual assumptions. And I thought that as the last talk of the day, this is kind of a nice way to wrap up. And I'm going to actually frame this the same way that Ping framed his starting talk, which is around the conceptual assumptions around transmission heterogeneity. And then I'm going to talk about using simple models to address heterogeneity. And then some of the more complex questions that we have around street-involved youth specifically, and how we're thinking about using some more complex models to address those types of interventions using agent-based models. And actually, I was thinking that this kind of brings me back to my dissertation work, which was really rooted around the conceptual assumptions and thinking about wildlife disease transmission and the ways in which animal populations deviate from some of those theoretical assumptions and what that means for population persistence or extinction. And now that I work in human populations, I find that, in fact, I work on basically the exact same questions, just with a different host. So if we think back to Ping's talk from the first day of the workshop on Tuesday, there were some different things that we talked about in terms of transmission heterogeneity. We talked about how we had this epidemiological triangle, where we have the agent, which is the infectious pathogen that we're interested in, the host of the pathogen, and then the environment within which the host-pathogen interactions occur. And we assume, in a way, that we have a lot of homogeneity oftentimes in these different areas. So we assume that agents are have the same infectiousness. We assume that hosts, whether they're susceptible or infectious, can be treated more or less the same. We typically assume that infectiousness during the infectious period is homogeneous. And we also typically, for many pathogens, assume homogeneous mixing. And I think that what I'm going to do first is just talk about each of these as they relate to sexually transmitted infections. And so I'm going to start at the bottom, actually, which is to say that homogeneous mixing for sexually transmitted infections is an assumption that we have to deviate from. So sexual interactions and behaviors are not random or well mixed. And so we really have to think about the ways in which people choose partners, the duration of partnerships, and who your partners are. And what we do know is typically in a lot of the modeling work that's been done around sexually transmitted infections, we've stratified populations based on core groups. And we know that those core groups tend to really punch above their weight epidemiologically, in that we have these influential tails to the distributions, and that those people at the tails tend to really play a large role in transmission. Now, the challenge as an epidemiologist or as a modeler related to this is that often access to individual level data, or data that helps us to kind of think about how individuals mix with one another, is very limited. And often the data is aggregated above some upper bound, and so we lose some of that heterogeneity because of the way the data is reported. So for instance, this is a figure that talks about heterogeneity in sexual behavior from Anderson and May's book, and we can see that while most individuals probably have one partner in some duration of time, there are some individuals who have many more. But above some threshold, we start lumping everybody together. So in this case, this is individuals who have 15 or more partners per duration of time. Often in the literature, what we see when we're talking about kind of the general population is reporting that lumps everybody above three together. So they'll say you have zero partners, one partner, two partners, or three or more partners in some duration of time. And for some specific populations, that may not be sufficient to really capture the heterogeneity that we observe in the system. So this is actually just a figure showing for men and women the number of new same-sex partners per year and the number of survey respondents who answered that they had this number of new same-sex partners in a given year for the street-involved youth survey. What we see is that women who have female partners typically have a low number of new same-sex partners per year, and we do see that there are some men who have a very large number of same-sex partners per year. And likewise, we see, if you look at the scale, has significantly changed on the axis here. Now we're going all the way up to almost 200 new partners per year. And in the street-involved youth survey, many of these individuals are exchanging sex either for money or for shelter or for food. And so there's very much a different social dynamic around sexual partnerships and the ways in which sexual partnerships form and dissolve over time. So if we were to just think about individuals who have zero, one, two, or three or more partners, we lose, you know, this whole spectrum out at this tail end, which is important for the street-involved youth data. The other thing we tend to think about is that agents have the same infectiousness. And for most pathogens that are sexually transmitted, I think that's probably a reasonable assumption to make in many circumstances, but there are certainly examples where antibiotic-resistant strains may be more or less infectious or transmissible than wild-type strains, and we know that there has been antibiotic resistance emerge in gonorrhea strains, but at this point in time, there really doesn't seem to be excellent empirical data to suggest how that is related to transmissibility. But for chlamydia, we tend to assume that this is in fact the case, that chlamydia strains have the same infectiousness amongst individuals. Now if we think about the host and we think about all susceptible individuals being the same or all infectious individuals being the same, we have a lot of other things that we need to think about. Oftentimes, we want to model sexually transmitted infections by developing a heterosexual model and thinking only about heterosexual interactions, Or we might want to develop a model that specifically looks at, for instance, a population of men who have sex with men, so a same-sex model. What we actually find in the street-involved youth data is that a heterosexual model or a same-sex model is actually not sufficient to capture the dynamics, because so many of the individuals in the data set have partners who are both of the same sex and of the opposite sex. And in fact, up to 38% of the individuals surveyed had partners in both of those groups. And so that potentially plays an important role in the dynamics. And so using a model that's only a heterosexual model may not be sufficient to really capture the dynamics that we observe within the street-involved youth population. The other interesting heterogeneity is around partnership duration. So individuals who are part of this survey are given opportunities to talk about whether their partners are what we would call a regular partner, so a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a spouse who they have sexual encounters with repeatedly over time on a regular basis, partners who are casual partners, or potentially partners who fall into both of those categories. So they may have a regular partner, and they may also have individuals who are casual partners or who are paying partners if that's part of the way they earn their living. One of the things that's really important, we know from the literature, and something that we're very interested in, is thinking about concurrent partnerships, because right now the survey data actually doesn't capture, does not capture well concurrency in terms of how many of those partnerships are overlapping. And so that's something that we're really thinking about moving forward, whether there are ways to collect data related to concurrency in a way that we would be able to use to inform the model development. We also know that individuals are not the same in terms of different types of behaviors. So there's a high degree of variability in population sex behaviors in general, but there's also a high degree of variability in population protective behaviors. So there's a lot of heterogeneity around things like condom use or other types of protective behaviors. In terms of sexually transmitted infections, we also tend to assume equal infectiousness during the infectious period. And for something like chlamydia, that's an assumption that we're quite comfortable with oftentimes, but for some sexually transmitted infections, we know that actually is not the case. So this is a figure from a paper in the Journal of Infectious Diseases that describes HIV transmission. And we know that with HIV, which is a sexually transmitted infection, that you do not have equal infectiousness during your infectious period. So in fact, you see a spike early on when the person is initially infected, and then the viral load tends to decrease until at which point the person progresses into the AIDS stage of their illness. And we know that sexually transmitted infections can actually cause spikes in that viral load, such that HIV-infected individuals have this initial spike. And then should they acquire another STI, such as chlamydia or gonorrhea, we see a spike in their viral load. And so this implies that this individual does not have equal infectiousness during the entire period of their infectious disease. And so we need to think about, if we're modeling something like HIV, ways to account for that differential infectiousness over time. So I think that from a public health standpoint, simple dynamic transmission models based on average effects are really excellent for working with public health professionals, especially if our question is sufficient to be addressed using a simple model. But I think that there are some heterogeneities around sexually transmitted infections, and failing to capture some of that heterogeneity in risk or in the natural history and biology can really lead to potentially unrealistic models or inaccurate projections. And from a public health standpoint, when we work with people who are actually trying to figure out how best to implement interventions in the field or how to really get the most bang for their buck, something that potentially may support ineffective disease control strategies is a real concern. So we need to kind of think about what's the simplest model we can build that describes the dynamics in a way that we're, you know, feeling quite good about the ways we've implemented the interventions in the model. So I'm just going to talk briefly about using a simple model to address heterogeneity, and I should say, first of all, that oftentimes my audience will primarily, since I've moved to the public health agency, my audience are not mathematically trained individuals. So you will not see any equations in my talk today. You may see some little pictures of people. But I'm going to talk about a simple model to address heterogeneity. And so the two examples I'm going to talk about, which are the UConn example and the Street Involved Youth Project, are both related to chlamydia. And a lot of times people wonder, well, you know, chlamydia, what happens if you get chlamydia? Because a lot of people have heard that people naturally clear chlamydia infection. So what's the big deal about chlamydia then? So the big deal is actually it is the most common notifiable disease in North America, but more importantly, the medical consequences in terms of the long-term implications of having untreated chlamydia are quite severe. So women especially can be asymptomatic for a long period of time and can develop pelvic inflammatory disease, which can require hospital care and medical interventions, and can lead to things like infertility and ectopic pregnancies. We also know that individuals who have chlamydia infections have increased rates of HIV, and there are potentially complications in newborn infants. So really, chlamydia disease itself is not the big concern. The concern is the long-term complications that arise from untreated chlamydia infections. And those untreated chlamydia infections, in terms of the complications, the burden of illness in a monetary sense, in terms of healthcare costs to deal with those long-term infections, likely exceeds $200 million annually in Canada. So this is a very big economic cost. So in the Yukon, a couple of the things we're interested in is that, first of all, and you may have heard this or you may not have heard this, but northern regions in Canada, if you look at the numbers, seem to have higher rates of sexually transmitted infections. And one of the questions has been, is that a real effect? Do we actually have higher rates in the north, or is it an artifact of surveillance in that we do a lot more testing in the north? For a variety of reasons. And David Vickers and Nate Osgood have done some really excellent work around these questions in Manitoba, and this is something that we're interested in doing in the Yukon. So thinking about whether what we see in the data is a current crisis or whether it is an artifact of surveillance. But really from a practice standpoint, what we're interested in doing is thinking about chlamydia screening and treatment. We know how much the Yukon is currently screening individuals, and we know how old those individuals are, but we're interested in knowing how much more would we need to screen and treat to be able to reduce the burden in the Yukon. One of the other things about chlamydia that's interesting is related to the risk of rebound, and that is that people who clear chlamydia infections naturally without being treated have some period of transient immunity. So they don't actually immediately go back to the susceptible group. They stay transiently immune for some duration of time, sometimes up to 2 years. If we start screening and treating people more, we actually truncate that duration of infection, because instead of having some people recover from their natural infection, we're treating lots of people, which immediately puts them back into the susceptible group. And in fact, what's been seen in British Columbia is that when we increase our screening and treating, what we see an immediate decline in the rates, but then we see a subsequent rebound, and in fact, BC has seen a rebound that went higher than the original rate. And so one of the questions has been, could we use a model to think about how much screening and treatment you could do without risking this rebound effect? And really, you know, from a public health standpoint, we're very much interested in how do you get the most impact with limited resources. So in terms of a simple model for chlamydia transmission, we're very much at this point using a sex-structured model for the Yukon. So the Yukon territory has, you know, 25,000 individuals, total population, give or take. So it's a small population. We have a simple SIR model where people enter the sexually active population and leave the sexually active population. Women transfer between groups based on the data that we have available to us. And what we actually find is that that simple model, just structured by men and women, simple model, actually fits the aggregated observed data very well. But from the territory standpoint, the thought is that the intervention would not be targeted at the entire population. The idea is that with very limited community resources in terms of trying to figure out what the best intervention is, the intervention would be targeted at specific age groups, specifically young adults and high school aged women, where the rates seem to be really increasing at a much larger rate. And so what we're working on now with Carolina is to expand the model into an age-structured model to look at the intervention strategies that UConn is interested in. One of the reasons for keeping this model simple from our standpoint is that we're also working to develop public health desktop tools. So what we've been doing with our models has been to develop front ends that run as applets so that someone can run the model essentially using sliders and buttons from Windows Explorer or their desktop without actually having the modeling software licensed on their computer. And so that really makes the case for addressing heterogeneity in a simple way so that we can be sure that our colleagues who are working in local or territorial public health can have a better understanding of actually what the model is doing. If we go to a desktop tool where we have a very complicated agent-based model, it becomes more difficult to really explain to people what's going on without kind of opening up the back end. And so for our purposes in the UConn, this has been our goal. And so we're, like I said, we've been starting to develop this front end where we can have the public health individuals, the public health officer, use this model for potentially looking at different STIs. And we would build a whole bunch onto this front end to think about dynamics specifically for the UConn. So like I said, sometimes we have groups come to us, specifically the street-involved youth group, who have much more complex questions around interventions. So when we think about the street-involved youth population in Canada, there actually are about 150,000 youth between the ages of 15 and 24 who are on the streets in Canada at any given day. And they come from a wide range of personal living situations and social factors. But the really important part about it is that the rate of sexually transmitted and bloodborne infections in this group is 10 to 12 times higher than youth who are the same age who are not street involved. That certainly is around a lot of things around different types of risk behaviors, drug and alcohol use, and it also is related to things like limited access to healthcare resources. So, like I said earlier, the Street Youth Surveillance Program at the Public Health Agency samples about 5,000 individuals from 7 Canadian cities, and the number of cities is actually growing every cycle. I think we're at 7 now. I think for next year we'll be up to 10. But the criteria is that the nurses interview people who are willing, and the criteria is that they have to have been absent from the place of residence for at least 3 nights in the last 6 months. So some of them may kind of go back and forth between home or someone's house and the street, but most of these kids are kids who live on the street full time. And they collect a wide range of information. And I should say that a lot of people sometimes say, I can't believe that people would be willing to sit down with a public health nurse and answer all of these questions, because they ask them things like related to demographics, which isn't really that sensitive, but they also ask a lot of personal questions around family history and their living situation, relationships with family members and other authority in their life and school, how they make money to live, drug and alcohol use, but they also ask lots of questions around sexual behavior, STI history, and they actually also take biological samples. And almost very few of the people who are interviewed actually decline giving a biological sample. So the survey has been quite good in terms of having response. So they collect urine and blood, and so they actually test all of the samples for sexually transmitted infections and bloodborne infections. So we know that chlamydia rates in Canada are increasing, and that's the blue line on this figure over time. And the burden in women tends to be, and this is the case in all territories and provinces, the burden in women is higher than in men. But what we see with the street-involved youth data, this bottom line here is percent infected in the general youth population in Canada, and these are street-involved youth up here. So the burden is still highest in women, but there's a big gap between the youth population and the street-involved youth population. So like I said, the data that we have from the survey in terms of heterogeneity regarding this population is quite extensive. There's a lot of information that's collected. And like I said, one of the things we're really interested in is concurrent partnerships. And the way that, because the data was not collected with modeling in mind, this is something that we actually are working with the team to maybe think about collecting some more information or adding some questions to get a better sense of whether or not these partnerships that are described in the survey are serial partnerships or whether or not they're concurrent partnerships. But we know that bridging behavior is common. So we have lots of individuals who have sex with both same-sex and opposite-sex partners. We have lots of individuals who have paying partners and regular partners and casual partners. So there's a lot of heterogeneity in terms of the population. And we could really develop a simple model, a relatively simple compartment model, to look at a variety of interventions. So we could develop a compartment model to look at things like increased condom use or increased access to care, behavior change in terms of educating youth about the role of concurrent partners in sexually transmitted infection risk. But one of the things that's new, kind of on the scene in terms of sexually transmitted infections, is something called expedited partner therapy. And what this means is we know that contact tracing is really the cornerstone of sexually transmitted public health interventions, which is that when someone tests positive for a sexually transmitted infection, that individual provides their doctor or the local public health nurse with, you know, the individuals who they have had sexual contact with in, say, the previous 3 months. And public health will follow up with those people to advise them that they may have been exposed to an infection and that they should seek treatment as a result. But we know that, in fact, the number of people who ever actually get contacted in contact tracing, who actually show up for treatment, is very, very low. And so with a street-involved youth population, that's even lower. So really, contact tracing is really not working in this population, because this is a highly mobile population who are hard to track down at the best of times, let alone to track down, you know, by telephone or something like that to try and find who you need to get treatment to. So the idea that that you would do something called expedited partner therapy seems to make sense. It's been a contentious issue in the U.S. because of legal issues, because each of the states has different legal requirements about issuing drugs to people without physically seeing them. So in expedited partner therapy, what you would do if you were the physician would be when someone arrives at the STD clinic and you suspect they have chlamydia, instead of doing this contact tracing routine where we go through public health, the physician says, how many partners have you had in the last 3 months? And if the person says three, then the doctor takes three tablets of azithromycin, puts them in three envelopes with an information package, staples it on, and says, here is the medication. Please deliver this to your partners. Because, you know, untreated partners, if you continue to have sex with your partner and your partner is untreated, then the treated woman typically will continue to be reinfected, and that's what we want to avoid. And so testing this idea of expedited partner therapy to see what sort of effect would implementing expedited partner therapy in this population have, would that really be sufficient to try and drive those rates down? And are there different criteria? So, you know, how would you decide who you were going to do expedited partner therapy with and who didn't? You know, are there certain characteristics of individuals who might mean that you get the drug into the more core groups? And so to be able to really do that in a model requires the ability to follow partnership history of individuals. So we have to be able to know who the person's former partners were to be able to implement the intervention in the model. And so what we've been doing has been to develop an agent-based model for the street youth population, where the agents or the individuals in the model are broken down by a variety of characteristics in terms of age, sex, partner choice, partnership type, risk behaviors, and most importantly, this partner history. So being able to track who the person's last partners were in some duration of time so that we can implement that across the model. So just to wrap up, we really are pursuing a variety of different ways to integrate heterogeneity into models at the public health agency. And I think we're, you know, using a variety of different techniques, both mathematical tools and more simulation-based, agent-based tools, to examine the impact of a variety of different types of intervention strategies on STI prevention and control. But I think that as we've heard throughout this week's talks, you know, the methodology that we use and the level of heterogeneity that we incorporate into these models is really going to be driven by the public health question of interest and obviously the available data. You know, developing a street use model as an agent-based model would not be possible if we did not have this extensive survey instrument that we have multiple years worth of data from. And we know that using the average literature values for the general population would not be sufficient to describe chlamydia transmission in a street-involved youth population. So as I said, it really is driven by the question and the data. So I'll wrap up on that note, and I'm happy to answer questions.